politicians got education into this mess? Can or even should they get us out of it? We will ask one. Kids behaving badly does not mean adults get to. Moving beyond politics and discipline, let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From WCPO.com, Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin. Children were sexually assaulted, poisoned because of teacher rally. Republican Governor Matt Bevin has opposed Kentucky teachers' rallies for pension protection and public education funding since they began, but never quite the way he did on Friday afternoon when he told a gaggle of reporters that the strike would directly cause children to be injured, poisoned, and sexually assaulted.
Wow.
Those are some harsh words for a day off of school.
What happens on snow days in Kentucky?
I don't know.
My goodness.
Call in the National Guard.
Those poor kids. Well, I, you know, being a PhD in education and being very familiar with education research, I will say that I've not come across this cause and effect relationship research in education. Teachers striking, poisoning, sexual molestation.
A direct cause and effect.
I've not seen it.
That's good, though.
I'm glad I haven't seen it. Right. I'd be interested to find out where the governor got his information as to making such a statement as this. He's pushing a little bit there. You know what we said? Poisoning.
It just seems like he's using... I couldn't tell when I first read this. I gasped when I saw it. And I'm like, is he using strong language to make a point, or does he really believe it?
Well, that's,
and it's hard to tell.
That could be a real problem, too, is if he really does believe it or is if he's making a point. Either way. Okay,
it's a lot.
Okay. If he was trying to make a point, we'll say the point he was trying to make is that teacher strikes can be inconvenient to families who might have some sense that their kids are supposed to be in school and now they have to be at home. And so what will they do? Mm-hmm. He also does go in to say it makes it very hard for a mother who relies or who doesn't have childcare, that if they don't have school, that makes it hard on them. Now, I would say, okay, Governor, you're right. So why not provide childcare then so that the mother doesn't have to worry about a teacher strike? But he doesn't go there. Instead, he worries about the child ingesting Tide Pods.
Right to the Tide Pod.
Because we know that when teachers strike, parents leave Tide Pods out for
everywhere.
Their kids. Yes.
Everywhere.
This is crazy insanity here.
Yes, it is.
Okay, whether you're for teacher strikes or whether you're not, teachers are across the nation right now standing up and saying something's wrong. We're not being compensated well. We're not being treated well. You need to do something about this. This movement, rhetoric against the strike, if we're going to have rhetoric against the strike, let's not talk about things such as sexual molestation and poisoning as the result of teacher strikes. Because when you do that, you're just crazy.
From NPR.org, Stoneman Douglas teacher is arrested after leaving gun in bathroom stall. Sean Simpson, a teacher at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, has spoken in favor of gun control efforts, and he said he might be open to the idea of carrying a gun in class. Now he has been arrested after leaving his Glock 9mm pistol in a bathroom over the weekend.
Uh-oh.
Okay.
Right.
When I saw this...
Go ahead.
Whoa.
Dude.
Dude, you need some help hanging on to that thing.
Right. Because you assumed...
It's at the school.
He left it in the school. And see, and actually, I think there's legitimate criticism for this article because the article makes it sound like that's what he did.
It does. Okay. I read that.
That's not excusing bad behavior and not having a little tie thing attached to your Glock.
The little zip thing. Yeah,
right.
You need that.
You know, when you're in there doing number two, that you should have something attached to your Glock so that you don't
right.
leave it there.
Exactly.
But it wasn't a bathroom in the school.
No.
But it is interesting that this is a teacher that was at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, where the massacre occurred. And he has, even from the very first paragraph of this article, he has been, we'd say, a bit ambivalent as to whether he would carry a gun, but yet at the same time has been somewhat talking about gun control. So,
right.
You know, So now, though, do you say, dude, if you can't keep your gun attached to you when you're in the bathroom at a park or something, I'm pretty sure that when you sign up to be one of the gun carrying teachers, we're going to disqualify you.
Probably. I think, you know, past history will probably catch up with them there.
But, you know, I've heard a lot of people, you know, and I think this is one of the examples. What this story really does is shows you, though, a responsible gun owner and the ability sometimes to forget where you put things and leave mm-hmm. it out. And so when we've heard about the idea of arming teachers, one of the first things we talk about is that immediately putting the gun in a teacher's hands in a classroom ups the chances of an accident.
Right.
And mm-hmm. that accident is what we're really looking at here. And so this illustrates that what happens, having the gun, you leave it, you walk out. Could this have been, if this was an armed, trained teacher ready, does the possibility exist then, though, that when they go into the school bathroom, that they might leave the gun in the bathroom? Well, yeah, if it can happen in a park, it could happen at a school. And so this is, I think, more a cautionary tale that we need to think really hard. If we're going to arm teachers,
give them the little janitor
key ring. Or we might really want to think hard about whether or not that's a type of thing we want to put at risk. The idea that we might forget where the gun is and then the accidents that will happen afterwards. So, dude, keep your gun attached to you at all times, man.
From the Network for Public Education, NAEP results are in. The era of corporate school reform has failed. Our nation's report card, which is what the NAEP scores are commonly called, paints a grim picture of the effects of nearly two decades of test-driven, top-down reforms based on business practices.
Another failure for public schools? My goodness, it never stops.
And it still makes headlines.
Actually, this is good news. If you understand what's actually being said here. So the NAEP, which is the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the nation's report card, is given to a small sample across the country of children mm-hmm. so that we can measure reading and math proficiency.
Okay. Right?
And as we look at this over 20 years, what have the results done? The results have stayed flat. So the idea that, quote, corporate school reform has failed, what they're talking about here is saying that taking over schools the way we have in the past 20 years, turning them into test prep factories that deny kids recess, that deny kids mm-hmm. history, that deny kids social studies, that only focus on driving test scores up, it doesn't work. First of all, at driving test scores up, because we've got 20 years of data to show that it doesn't. And sadly, though, you'd have to say there's been no growth over 20 years. So how much harm have we done in the name of test scores to bring them up? We haven't even brought them up.
Well, what my favorite part in here, it says, it's a train wreck. They don't need, they're not even sugarcoating this.
No.
It's not saying, well, there's some good and some bad. No, this has just been a mess, and it's time to say, okay, we're done.
And we should be at this point. Is the evidence clear? Yes, the evidence is clear. We have taken the nation's report card. We have looked at the data over the past 20 years. Kids' scores have remained flat. Some of the gaps that we were going after for the longest times still remain. In fact, some of them have increased. So the method, test and punish, accountability, corporate reform, you call it what you want. But we need to say that the method right there is a train wreck, is a failure.
Time for Tim to rant. This is Someone Has to Say It.
Beyond discipline, what would it mean to move beyond discipline? That's a tough question today. In the wake of the Obama administration's warning to schools that children of color and children of poverty are disproportionately suspended or, quote, disciplined unfairly, some schools implemented behavior plans that seem to dismiss bad behavior. This in turn led to a sense of anything goes, and teachers were left dealing with administrators who insisted on lowering the number of behavior referrals and parents that lashed out about teachers who were not holding certain children accountable for disruptive behavior. Now, the shift to regain control seems to be on the loose. Commercial behavior plans are all the rage, and professional development on PBIS and other behavioral control techniques dominate the landscape. Why? Why fall back on compliance-driven techniques? Why the control, the management? Isn't there something else? What about looking at a classroom and children as a community? What if the development of real relationships with students was the goal? What if we imagined a democratic classroom where all participated? No need, because in the last segment of the show, we will talk to Alfie Cohn about moving beyond discipline. Oh, and hey, he also wrote a book by the same name. Check it out. He is as Wisconsin as cheese curds. You can find him at governorbluejeans.com. He is a candidate for governor for the Democratic Party, Mike McCabe, and he is back on Busted Pencils. So welcome back, Mike.
Thanks for having me back.
I'm surprised you came back.
I'm not.
You're not?
I'm delighted you asked, and that's an easy one to say yes to.
Well, because I haven't
busted any pencils for a while.
We got yelled at for busting pencils, and you know, some teachers are running short of supplies, and so we had a so-called guest call in and say, you shouldn't be busting pencils when teachers need those pencils. So, you know, it is a metaphor, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so hopefully that's... But you're going to bust some pencils pretty soon.
Happy to.
All right. So we talked. It's been probably 4 months, but a lot has happened, and it's an education. What education have you received being on the trail?
This has been an unbelievable experience. We've traveled over 60,000 miles just since I announced my candidacy back in September. Have gone to every part of the state. The unbelievable part of this experience is that we all live in bubbles, and this is one of those rare opportunities to travel from bubble to bubble to bubble. I get to go in other people's bubbles and hear and see what they're dealing with and what they're riled up about, and it's just incredible, and it's a tremendous blessing to be able to just listen to what's on people's minds.
I was going to say, so have you? Did you burst any of those bubbles?
Well, I'll tell you.
It's
a learning experience. You gain incredible insight about what people are frustrated about, struggling with, challenged by all across the state. And it varies from place to place. There are certainly some common themes that come up everywhere you go. Okay. But then there are also some unique issues that are brought up depending on which region of the state you're in.
And I'll spend a few minutes talking about those common themes, and then we will hit really hard education. But I mean, what give me one of the common themes you keep hearing.
Everything from the inability of so many people to find work that pays a living wage, the inability of people to actually work and be in the middle class. That's huge. Roads and transportation infrastructure. That's an issue everywhere. Water. Access to clean, drinkable water, and you know, that's something that it manifests itself differently. In Milwaukee, it's lead pipes. It's also lead in the water in Lake Mills. But then you go to western Wisconsin, sand mining is affecting the water quality. You go to places like Kewaunee County or Calumet County in the east, and there it's indiscriminate manure spreading, and people can't turn on a water faucet and drink what comes out because their water is poisoned. Schools are obviously on people's minds everywhere. Healthcare is a theme that comes up everywhere. Access to healthcare and the ability to afford to go to the doctor. Mm-hmm. But schools, that comes up everywhere.
And so good. Then you led right into it.
Yep.
So what is it about schools? What comes up? What's the issue?
Well, you know,
when
you get out into rural Wisconsin, they are scared to death about having to bust their kids an extra 45 minutes or an hour on top of what they're already traveling to get to school because they're afraid that they're going to have to close their local elementary school or maybe even their local high school. And I grew up in Clark County.
Okay.
And not far from a little town named Dorchester. Dorchester's right now going through the agonizing process of deciding whether to close their local elementary school and bust the kids off to Abbotsford.
How much of that just... Because the critic might say, look, we have a population that's declining. the number of children enrolled in schools is smaller. Mm-hmm. These school districts are shrinking. They have to, quote, consolidate, move, and that this is just the reality of rural, of living in rural Wisconsin. Or is it a mechanized, as some people would say, no, it's a defunding?
I don't think there's any question that it's been defunding. And you look at since the 2008 recession, since the Great Recession, Wisconsin's in the top 10 of states that have seen their education funding shrink the most. That's not a good top 10 list to be on, but we're right up near the top. And in the early years of the Walker administration, Wisconsin was actually leading the nation in cuts to funding and education. Now, he added back a little bit in this most recent budget. Right. We're still lagging badly, and we're still solidly in the top 10 when it comes to states that have watched education funding decline the most of all the states around the country. So, and that's really hit with the force of a bomb in small rural communities, because they were already sort of living on the edge, and now that's pushing a lot of them over the edge, and they don't have the ability to keep their doors open.
So it's interesting, though, too. You said bubble, so that's a bubble. It's rural Wisconsin, and you're talking about schools, but you said something very unique. They're concerned about the loss of their local elementary school, and yet funding cuts. And what I wonder about is, do they have a sense, or are the people you're talking to have a sense as to who is responsible for the possibility that they might lose their public school?
They assume that the folks in charge at the Capitol are responsible. Although some of them will just blame their local school board members or the local administrators. They just know that their school's in trouble, and that concerns them. Because when a local school closes, mm-hmm. that's a death sentence for that small town.
Right.
That's such a hub of community activity. But you know, here's the interesting thing, Tim. The more Republicans foul up government, those who are in charge of our state government right now, the more they foul it up, the easier it is for them to win elections, because people go for the default option of voting for the anti-government party. When they're frustrated about government dysfunction, when they think government is failing them, they actually then are more inclined to vote for the anti-government party. So that's a dilemma for Democrats.
That's where I was going with this, too, to talk about, you know, again, everybody's different, but there is kind of a voting perspective in rural Wisconsin that would typically favor Walker and the Republicans. However, if we would look at, if we say budget cuts are the biggest devastating hit to local small rural counties, then when you present an alternative or something like this, is there pushback? You know, wait, Walker wouldn't do this. He's anti-government. My local Republican wouldn't do this. How do you wrestle with that?
Actually, they're all ears. The thing is, I think Democrats haven't made them a better offer for a long time, and Republicans have very skillfully peddled an anti-government message. And when people are frustrated with government, they listen to that message and it resonates with them, and they go ahead and vote Republican. But when somebody goes out there and actually is willing to listen to them and actually travel to their communities, they don't see many candidates for governor come their way. And when somebody's actually willing to go out there and listen and then say, look, we need to restore local democracy. We need to restore some local control. You've had your own ability to make decisions about your schools and so many other issues in your local community taken away from you by those who are in charge at the Capitol. We really ought to restore local democracy, and we ought to make sure that every school everywhere has decent funding, mm-hmm. because that's critical to your community's health. You lose your local school, that is a death sentence for your small town. They get all that, and they're all ears. They're saying, okay, tell us more. How do we do this?
Right. And then when
they're open to a different message. They've been written off for too long. Democrats have stopped competing out in places like where I'm from.
Okay, because I wanted to know that when you say you give them, and they're all ears, and you say, okay, so then vote for me, a Democrat, do the ears go, I can't do that?
Some do. You know, there are some people who have become very tribal about politics, and they can't veer from their party. But I think you're seeing a rapidly shifting political landscape out in more rural parts of the state. I think people are feeling very written off and very forgotten, and they're frustrated. They feel looked down upon. They kind of feel like all the people in the Capitol must not even know they're out there. And they want something better than that, and I think they're open to change. So you don't have to win everybody over. You just got to win over enough people to create governing majorities. And I think some votes can be had out in rural Wisconsin.
We are talking to Democratic candidate for Governor Mike McCabe. When we get back, I want to come after this point, though, Mike. You talk about Democrats' lack of responding to particularly issues in education, Mike. You hinted at the possibility that on education, Democrats maybe, in fact, in the rural areas and maybe all across the state, have not been very good at responding to the concerns.
Well, I think in general, Democrats have focused on places like Madison and Milwaukee.
Okay.
And they've neglected other parts of the state, even written off other parts of the state, where they just don't go out and compete. And so they don't go out and talk to people about school issues. And I think also on education issues specifically, Democrats have played along with a lot of the education reform initiatives that we've seen in recent years or even in the last decade or two that have primarily been driven by the right. We're just testing kids to death now. All of it was done in the name of accountability, but we're not letting teachers teach. We're not letting students learn. We're forcing teachers to just teach to the test, and then we're testing the kids to death. All in the name of education reform, all in the name of education accountability. And then, of course, Democrats went along with revenue limits and teacher salary caps, and they sort of bought into all of that as well, and in the name of keeping property taxes low.
Neoliberalism is the big thing that comes through.
And all of it has pushed schools to the brink of collapse, particularly in rural areas. It's demoralized teachers across the state and led a whole bunch of teachers to flee the profession. And then you got fewer young people wanting to enter the profession. Fewer are going into teacher training. And that sets us up for disaster over the long haul. And local communities are struggling to keep their schools alive. And it's important for a small town to keep its school alive. Its community's existence depends on it. And they haven't heard really new thinking from Democrats. So Democrats have got to go out there with, I think, a much more bold and ambitious agenda and a message that isn't same old on education.
Was that you?
Well, everywhere I go, I talk about how we can't afford to continue to fund two separate and parallel systems of education, one public and one private. I've called for ending taxpayer-subsidized private schooling. I refuse to call it the choice program.
Right.
Because it doesn't provide people choices that they didn't already have. The vast majority of voucher recipients already were privately schooling their kids. They already had the choice to send their kids to private schools. The only thing that's changed is now all taxpayers subsidize that decision. Mm-hmm. And I've called for ending that so that we can reroute the resources to our public schools and do justice by funding community schools and strengthen them.
And I've heard a majority of the Democrats running say something along those lines.
They're coming along.
You've been definitely much more clear as to saying these things. But, I want to go back, though, to some of
But think about it, Tim. For years, Democrats were only willing to say, well, maybe we should limit the further expansion of the voucher program, or maybe we should hold voucher schools a little bit more accountable. I said, no, if a program's 27 years old and hasn't delivered the promised results, you end that program and you use the funding for a more constructive purpose. Now some of the candidates, after hearing that, are starting to say, well, me too. I kind of think that way as well. But yeah, in this campaign, we're really changing the conversation. I was the first to come out for ending taxpayer-subsidized private schooling. I was the first to come out to say we should make Badger Care a public option available to everybody in the state, regardless of income. I was the first to say that we should fully legalize marijuana to deal with the impact of how that impacts mass incarceration. Now you've got quite a few of the other candidates sort of joining me on some of those positions. That's one of the ways that I've been able to change the conversation. But the education debate needed changing in the worst way.
Yeah, and so we've moved it on choice. That's great. But let's get back to, I think, I don't know which one's bigger or not, but you talked about
demoralization of teachers, yeah. You know, which is something that we talk a lot about on Busted Pencils. You know, we have teachers out there. I know right here where we broadcast the show or where we record the show here in Madison, I've got at least 5 to 7 teachers that I know are on their way out, mm-hmm. and has nothing to do with not loving kids, not wanting to be an awesome teacher, has everything to do with demoralization and the conditions. Mm-hmm. And you started hinting about that, but, you know, what is it? When do Democrats learn to make the connection, or are you starting to make the connection to saying we're setting up teachers for failure, not only our schools?
Well, you know, a long time ago, I was involved in education work, and actually was appointed to a statewide task force on school funding, and we came up with the idea of the SAGE program, which was to reduce class sizes to 15 in the early grades. And the SAGE program was, in fact, that recommendation was put into effect for a while. Walker got rid of it eventually. One of the things we can do to help teacher morale is to put them in a situation where it's easier for them to succeed. Give them smaller, more manageable class sizes. Give them better supports. When they're dealing with a really high need group of kids with developmental disabilities, make sure that there are assistants or aides in that classroom so that they don't spend all of their time managing the behavior of one or two kids and neglecting everybody else in the classroom. And then, of course, Act 10 is not a sustainable policy over the long haul. Mm-hmm. And when we've got a situation where more and more veteran teachers are leaving early and fewer young people are entering the profession, going into teacher training, that's a recipe for disaster. So that says to me that over the long haul, what we've done with school budgets and with teacher compensation is not sustainable. We've got to, you know, so there are all these ways that we can address the root causes of declining teacher morale, but there hasn't been the political leadership to direct the conversation in that way.
I finally hear somebody starting to get at a little bit of this, and I appreciate that you're going there because it makes me then push the issue that I've been pushing hard, which is, do we have a teacher shortage, or do we have a teacher exodus? And if you label one way, you come up with a solution. If you label one the other way, you might have different solutions.
Right.
And
right.
So I'll throw it, and I asked you this the first time, but I'll throw it back at you again. Now it's late. What do you think?
I think teachers are fleeing, which makes it an exodus.
Okay, so
it's not just a shortage of there's. It's not just that there's too small a pool of possible teachers out there. We're actually having teachers fleeing. Mm-hmm. And then we're having fewer and fewer young people seeing it as an appealing option to pursue the teaching profession. So that looks to me like an exodus, not a shortage.
Okay, so we've labeled it then, if we go with that. So this hopefully has some policy implications for solving it. And,
yeah.
You know, what I've seen right now coming out of Wisconsin, whether it be Democrats or Republicans, largely Democrats, has been this idea of alternative routes, emergency certification, faster. We need to send as many untrained people into our classrooms as we possibly can quickly because the shortage. And for what about unsustainable.
Yeah, what a disastrous approach. The response to school districts having an opening and no applicants, the response has been, well, let's just lower the standards of preparation for teachers so we can pretty much let anybody get in the classroom and then we'll be able to fill those openings. No, we got to look at the actual root causes of why you have openings and no applicants. And that does deal with classroom conditions, class sizes, the level of support that teachers have for the student populations they're trying to serve, teacher compensation. All of those are factors that are going to determine whether somebody wants to keep working in that classroom. And if you don't address that stuff, then it's a race to the bottom. We just will continue to lower standards and say pretty much anybody can go in a classroom. And I've been in enough classrooms and I've worked with enough teachers and I've been around schools enough to know it is a really, really hard job to teach. And not everybody can do it. Certainly not everybody can do it well. And it takes some real serious preparation and expertise. We need to raise standards for teacher preparation, not lower them. We're going in exactly the opposite direction we should be going in, as far as I'm concerned. That's tragic. And to the extent that Democrats buy into that, as well as Republicans, I think that's just a vacuum of leadership that needs to be addressed in our state.
Well, Mike, maybe there's going to be an opportunity to fill that vacuum here.
It sure needs to be filled. That's right.
So, Mike, if I'm interested in the campaign, where do I go?
GovernorBlueJeans.com is the website, and you can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter and all the social media. But
anywhere you're going to be, and if anybody you want to, you know, in the next week or so.
It's just
you're going to be everywhere.
I was just in La Crosse, going to Whitewater, and then Fort Atkinson, and then Milwaukee, all over the state.
And
every
I know
day.
We're also going to see you on May 12th at Educators Amplified in Milwaukee for that special governor's race. And so that's actually hosted by Busted Pencils there, too.
Terrific.
So we'll get to talk again.
Terrific.
And maybe even get some of these other Democrats on the record here. So
terrific.
But hey, Mike McCabe, good luck out there. And, look both ways when you cross.
Will do. Thanks, Tim.
From Milwaukee Teachers Education Association, teaching all children.
You are entering Cone Zone with author and activist Alfie Cone.
So, Alfie, I've been getting a lot of questions lately about behavior plans, issues of race, issues of restorative practice. And so I wanted to talk about this, this idea of, quote, controlling behavior. Mm-hmm. And management and rewards and punishments. And the idea that some parents think that if you move away from rewards and punishment, there is no control, that everything falls apart and there's no accountability. And, well, and I hate to put it this way, but a lot of white parents will say, and now my kids can't learn because these black kids are misbehaving.
Yeah, that little coda there at the end reveals a disturbing undercurrent of racism. But let's set that aside for the moment.
Okay.
Because I think even people without that agenda have this tendency to draw a false dichotomy, not just parents but teachers as well, and not just about what happens at school but about how you raise children.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, you can punish them when they do something bad in order to affect their future behavior. You can deliberately make them suffer in an effort to affect their future behavior and control them. On the other hand, you can do nothing. You can turn the other cheek. You can give them a chance. You can be a softy. You can be permissive. So if you set it up so that those are the only two options, then you have a pretty good explanation for why parents and teachers continue to make children suffer, even though research overwhelmingly shows that punishment of any kind is not merely ineffective, it's counterproductive. Study after study finds that children who are raised in more punitive environments, traditional kinds of discipline, are more aggressive and obnoxious than other children as soon as they're away from the punisher.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that nicely mirrors what research finds about the flip side of punishment, which is rewards, control through seduction.
Okay.
The options being either do this, or here's what I'm going to do to you, or do this, and you'll get that.
Right.
Both are ways of doing things to children. And the real alternative to that is not to let kids run wild. It's not to do nothing and create a laissez-faire environment. The real alternative, which takes a lot of time and skill and talent and care and courage, is to create a working with environment to solve the problems that underlie those kind of actions instead of just trying to smash them out through power and force.
So when we talk about that, then, as mm-hmm. you've referred to, and let's take, for example, what we say are very heavy KIPP schools, for example, have this no excuses discipline model.
Right.
And in that model, then, that's what you're talking about. This is a heavy punishment, maybe some rewards, but they swear up and down that they get results.
Well, you can only get one kind of result from treating kids like animals, which is basically what the KIPP schools do. I mean, I wouldn't send my dog to a KIPP school. This no excuses stuff. And by the way, here we come back to your original coda. Mm-hmm. It is not a coincidence that this heavy-handed, militaristic, public humiliation and token economy control is disproportionately reserved for low-income children of color. I mean, that is not a coincidence. It is consistently true. And many of the white middle-class teachers at these schools would never allow their own children to be humiliated and punished and stigmatized and bribed in the way they do black and Latino children. But in terms of the effects, look, we have decades of research showing that punishment of any kind, even the punishment light, L-I-T-E, of grounding kids at home or timeouts, let alone the heavy-handed kind of punishment for the slightest deviation from mindless obedience, which is what those no excuses schools are all about. They are not trying to help kids become caring, compassionate human beings, members of a community, or independent thinkers. They are trying to smash their will out of existence and make them do whatever they're told by authority figures. And the research shows that punishments and rewards can only work to get one thing ever, and that is temporary compliance at an enormous cost.
Right. Well, and that you look at that cost then specifically to learning any type of content, I would assume, because if you're essentially learning, minimal compliance at the expense of how much content is not being taught, how much community participation, how much peer relationship is being taught, if you're constantly being under the gun to comply.
Right. Well, on one level, you are impeding the development of moral agency.
Okay.
I mean, you cannot help children to become courageous people, to reflect on the impact of their actions on others if you use punishments and rewards. You're creating kids who are more egocentric. I mean, punishments and rewards lead kids to ask, what do they want me to do, and what happens to me if I don't do it? Or what do I get for doing it if it's like a terrible PBIS program, which is just, treating kids like pets? But in both cases, the question you lead kids to ask is entirely about self-interest. No punishment, even if you call it a consequence because it makes you feel better to not call it a punishment, no reward, even if you call it positive reinforcement for the same reason, ever helped a child think about right and wrong, only about self-interest and power. And what they learn is that when I have the power, I can cause other people who are weaker than I am to capitulate. That's what you teach. And temporarily, if the punishment is severe enough or the reward is enticing enough, you can get kids to jump through the hoops for a while. But as soon as they're away from the powerful person, or as soon as the punishments and rewards stop, they tend not only to revert to the original troubling actions, they double down on it. It tends to lead to more problems. But you raise an interesting question here, which is not just the effect of punishments and rewards on social and moral development, but the curious relationship between these controlling programs of classroom and school management and the academic curriculum.
Okay.
And it's really, and it works in two ways. It works both ways. When you have this kind of no excuses discipline, it's almost impossible to have a thoughtful curriculum that's about creativity, that's about understanding ideas from the inside out, student-centered, all the stuff that, you and I have talked about and you've talked about with other guests on this show, because you're really undermining the intellectual growth and construction of knowledge at the same time that you're undermining social and moral development. But as Linda McNeil and other other observers have pointed out, sometimes it works the other way, where teachers and administrators are more likely to choose a mind-numbing, worksheet-based skill and drill curriculum because that lends itself to control of the kids.
So
it may be that it's not merely we got to get you all in line so you can learn this stuff. And by I don't mean meaningful learning. I mean cram forgettable facts into short-term memory for a test. But it's that the curriculum may be chosen in part to reach the ultimate goal, which is controlling children. That's a fascinating idea to ponder.
Wow. Yeah, and if we put that there, so. But thinking about this, the alternative, though, as you started talking about this idea of meaningful relationships, moral development,
right,
is do we avoid it because what you just said, it's hard work?
Yeah, it's hard work, but it's not just hard work because you gotta figure out what strategies to use for which kids under which situations instead of this one-size-fits-all carrot-and-stick approach. It's also hard work because you have to be willing to share authority. As an adult, you have to be willing to ask more than tell. You have to be willing to have kids experience some version of democracy. How do we want our classroom to be during a class meeting where you figure out together what the goals are, not just the methods for reaching the teacher's goals? That requires you to be fast on your feet, to be sort of intellectually nimble, but it also requires an enormous degree of courage and trust and respect for kids. Respect for kids and trust in kids is entirely missing in traditional schools that say, here are the rules and here's what happens to you if you break them. There, you're giving the message to kids every day with suspension and detention and timeouts and lists of punitive consequences and point systems for conformity. All of those say to kids every morning, we don't trust you to do what's right, let alone to be able to grapple with the idea of what is right and why. We tell you how to act, and we manipulate you into acting that way. So that message of distrust would be enough to get most kids, except the, you know, the most, I guess, obedient ones. I mean, either kids are going to do what they need to in order to keep their heads down and play it safe, and then rebel when they have the chance.
Right.
Or they're going to rebel immediately. Mm-hmm. But neither is about moral growth. And I've spent many, many years learning from talented educators, watching them in practice, as well as reading lots of accounts of this sort of thing, of what it looks like to have a classroom or school that isn't hands-off, do whatever you want, we don't care if it's safe, but it also isn't this kind of top-down, heavy-handed punishment and reward control. To watch class meetings in operation, to watch teachers consult kids, develop caring relationships with them one-on-one so the children feel they matter to the grown-ups, and to watch the teachers facilitate caring relationships in the community of the classroom so that little by little kids really come to think in the plural, as I like to say, about what's best for us, not just for me, and how so that kids wouldn't want to hurt others, whether they're being watched or not. I mean, this is just breathtaking stuff, and I've seen it happen in urban, rural, and suburban environments. I've seen it in elementary schools and high schools. So the one argument you can't make to prop up the traditional punishment and reward system is that it's unrealistic to do without it for those kids. The reality is we've got loads of examples supported by good research showing that it's not only possible, but far more effective to work with kids than it is to do things to them.
He is the author of so many books and so many articles, and we are so happy and lucky to have him on Busted Pencils, and that was an awesome Cones Zone. Alfie, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Alfie also wrote a book called What Are the Schools Our Children Deserve? Author and school administrator Linda Nathan has an answer.
Well, one of the first things I would make sure is that the schools that our children deserve have lots and lots of making and doing in them. So I think about arts. Other people might think about other kinds of makings and doings. But I don't want school to be a preparation for life. I want school to be life. So I want to make sure that there's all kinds of vocational experiences, all kinds of career and technical experiences. I want the classroom to be a studio, and I want there to be every day is about thinking through a different problem with different materials, learning to work collaboratively and creatively with lots of different people who may look different than me, may come from different backgrounds, but that I enjoy working with them. And then I want these schools to be literature rich and places of joy and play. One of the coolest schools I've ever been to had an inside slide in the building. So this is an elementary school. Kids would slide down to their classrooms. And I just thought that was, you know, such a cool idea, that the idea of kids laughing. School can be a place of laughter. It doesn't have to be all of this seriousness. Doesn't mean kids don't learn a lot, but I want schools to be places where kids fundamentally learn to get along with people who may not be like themselves.
Time now for our salute to historian and activist Howard Zinn. This is your moment of Zinn.
Voting is easy and marginally useful, but it is a poor substitute for democracy, which requires direct action by concerned citizens.
My thanks to candidate McCabe, Linda Nathan, and Alfie Cohn. Be sure to check out his book, Beyond Discipline, From Compliance to Community. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thank you for Busting Pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.